Welcome to the Gastric Health Show, where we help you achieve the happiest and healthiest version of yourself by motivating you to eat, move, sleep, and think better. David, welcome to the Gastric Health Show and excited to have you. And if you could maybe share a little bit about your story, how you became an addiction expert, and kind of the background of how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, sure. I'll start in childhood, if that's okay, because I think that's where it started for me is, I used to come home from school and like in the winter, I'd have like hat and gloves on, a backpack, a parka, right? I just run down the stairs. Mm-hmm. I hit the pantry. I grab like 5 bags of fruit snacks and I'd hide the wrappers. Oh. And I couldn't really explain that. Like I didn't know what I was doing. I just knew I did it. It turns out later, my mom ended up identifying initially as a compulsive overeater and then identifying as a food addict. And so I think that had a big thing to do with my childhood and just kind of being around that. And definitely, I think I have a genetic disposition to food and sugar addiction. So I think that's a big part of it. I mean, if you shake my family tree, a bunch of addicts fall out. It's just the reality. So Definitely the genetic piece is really strong. And then ultimately, let's see, I always love to cook. I love feeding people. My whole family, they're feeders. They just like, they'll like watch you eat. They just want to please you with food. So I think that was a big part of it. So I went to culinary school ultimately, and then I decided that I also wanted to help people. So then I started going into nutrition and I followed a relatively routine nutritional paradigm for myself. It didn't really work. I always suffered from cravings. But part of my story is that I was on amphetamines for 25 years for ADHD. So it really suppressed my appetite a lot. So even as a kid, I wouldn't really eat during the day. I would like eat for 3 adults at dinner, but like I wouldn't eat much during the day. Yeah. And I was a relatively normal weight kid. I ate a lot of carbs and brown food and things like that. So I went to culinary school. Then I was sort of on a whim. I decided to apply to get my master's and do a dietetic internship. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that would help me help people better.
Right.
And so I went through that program. I ended up in Ohio State and I did the program there. And then I was working initially in an ICU. I was helping people really with enteral nutrition support, tube feeding, parenteral nutrition, feeding people in their veins. And I really didn't find the work rewarding, mainly because I wasn't interacting with people. Most of them were on the ventilator.
And then
actually entered, I was in New Jersey at the time and wanted to find my way back home. To start the process of raising a family. Mm-hmm. And I moved back to Boston and started working in a bariatric center helping people get prepared for bariatric surgery. Right. And I think that's when I was finally given the opportunity to work with addicts, whether they knew they were or not. But that was really the part of my job that I loved the most was really being in the trenches and helping people realize what was going on for them. And then as a result of that, I've started my own personal recovery journey. And actually my own personal recovery journey actually started when I stopped working there. And that was the impetus to kind of take a look at my life and change a lot of things. And that pretty much brings me up to speed now, where I run a addiction community online, which is called Sugar Global. It's a community-based platform. We run groups and things like that, but we're really helping people get in on the ground floor so they can build the life that they love.
Yeah. Which is, I think, a big piece in healthcare that is missing. No one is really addressing this piece. We all have to eat. We all have, histories that people created behaviors for us as children that we had no say in. It was just kind of developed. And so here we are as adults, trying to deal with where we were, where we're at, and how do we get out of life what we're wanting and still feel like we can eat, still feel like we don't have to follow a diet, or you know, whatever you're hoping for. You know, you get kind of confused. It's so confusing because no one's really talking about food addiction really is real. And maybe this is a small piece of what you're missing in your healing part after weight loss surgery.
Right. We say it's the elephant in the room, right? It's that thing that's in the living room that you're like walking around all day, but no one's talking about it.
Yep. I agree. I mean, you just think about, I mean, I still work at a bariatric center, and our break room is no different than any other break rooms in America.
Sure.
And, sure. But it's like, here we are the experts. We are supposed to be the experts. But yet people bring in donuts, people bring in cakes and all this stuff. And, you know, surgeons walk in with their Diet Cokes or their regular Cokes and Mountain Dew. But yet, because they don't have obesity there, it's not a problem.
But, right. At least not on the outside. So,
right. Right. Little do they, right. Yeah. And that's because no one's really talking about this. So I think, you know, how do you define sugar addiction?
Well, it's a hard question to answer. There's a couple things that we can use. We can take a look at the substance abuse criteria that the ICD-10 puts out and the DSM puts out. And so there are some characteristics that help people diagnose substance abuse disorder. Okay. Some of them are things like use despite consequences. Like we continue to use even though it starts to complicate our life. Mm-hmm. Consequences could be on a physical paradigm. They could be like affecting our body, affecting our weight. They could be on an emotional paradigm. Mm-hmm. They could be on a social paradigm. They affect the relationships that we have. Like, do you have any relationships in your life that have been impacted negatively by the way that you continue to use or abuse food? Yeah. That's one way to look at it. Withdrawal or tolerance, right? Mm-hmm. Do you need more than you needed before to get the same effect? Mm-hmm. And then withdrawal is what happens to you physically, psychologically, emotionally when you stop using.
Yep.
Right. I met with a 21-year-old person yesterday and who was kind of on the fence about this whole thing.
Okay.
And she's had like 7 or 8 active symptoms and she's 21. There's a total of, I think you can rack up a total of 24.
Okay. So, name some of them.
Some of the symptoms would be like, have you given up some of the social parts of your life so that you could use food instead? Mm. Have you eaten more than you intended to? Have you eaten for longer than you intended to? Have you continued to use sugar, even though a medical professional has urged you to do otherwise? Yeah. Those are like a few of them.
Okay.
So it, yeah. And the symptoms as they accrue, they don't go away.
Yeah.
Right. They're either dormant or they're active.
Yeah.
So if you enter a period of recovery or dormancy or abstinence really from the substance, the behaviors may subside, but when you return to active use, the symptoms return.
Yeah.
Then they don't come in a staggered way. They'll return all at once.
And would you say stronger or?
Yeah. I mean, you know, people have sayings, they say like, the disease is in the parking lot doing pushups and things like that, you know, to kind of symbolize that, like, even though you're not using, the disease is still progressing, which is true.
Do you kind of qualify a sugar addiction the same as alcohol, drugs, sex? I mean, in the weight loss surgery community, it's talked about frequently transfer of addictions.
Sure.
That's why we see so many alcoholics after they're just taking their food addiction and they're transferring it to alcohol or shopping or sex. I mean, how do you differentiate, or is there a difference? Are they all the same?
I look at it like it's an outlet. So if I'm a sugar addict, my outlet is sugar. Mm-hmm. If I transfer to alcoholism, then my outlet is alcohol. But the addiction doesn't change. It's just the substance and the behavior changes.
Yeah.
So we say one disease, many outlets. So generally speaking, most addicts have multiple outlets. The reality is that they just don't see them until one of them goes away. And you kind of end up playing a little bit of whack-a-mole.
Yeah.
So, and then you see like in the alcoholic community or in the drug addiction community, you see what appears to be of transference from alcohol and drugs to sugar.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
But in reality, it was likely a transference from sugar to alcohol to drugs back to sugar.
Yeah.
And so I think part of that is society norms.
Right.
Yeah. It's normal for you to be able to put sugar in your coffee and have a donut and whatever. I mean, and look at like you're talking about break room culture, things like that.
Yeah.
So it's normalized. It's not normal. It's become normalized. So I think we have to assume that disease is the same. It's just that the substance changes.
Is it common to have multiple ones going at the same time? Are most people going to have like three or four, or is it usually like one or two or five or six? I mean, how many addictions are common?
It depends. I think a lot of people have addictions that they don't realize they have, because they're in the background. I haven't had a drink or sugar in 4 years. Mm-hmm. And so, I realized I did a training recently to advance my own skills, you know, in working with addicts. And I realized, well, work and screens are definitely a thing.
Okay.
So, right. So I wasn't aware of that until like 3 months ago.
Okay.
So I thought I had two, and then there's two more. Mm-hmm. Right. So I think we, uncover, discover, discard, right? So it's a process. Yeah. As we let go of one, we realize, oh, this seems to be coming up for me too. Like at one point I was drinking about 3 cups of coffee a day.
Okay.
And caffeinated. And I realized that though that isn't all that much coffee, considering some people drink a lot more than that. It was addiction to me in that I was seeking more.
Yeah.
Right. For no other reason than to seek more.
Yeah.
So I got rid of coffee. So as we learn about these things, we come to the awareness, and then we can start to act on the awareness.
Yeah.
But I think the awareness piece is huge.
Yeah. Coming to terms with, I might need some deeper work. Because I mean, if we talk about kind of go a little more upstream of what's happening, the reason why addiction is such an issue is what's happening in the brain, right?
Sure.
So maybe explain, why someone would need these outlets when they have whatever happening.
So there's a couple different models to try to explain this. And we believe in the biopsychosocial model, right? So what that means is, and also we also believe that addiction is a primary illness, which means it comes first.
Okay.
So addiction isn't a response to trauma.
Okay.
In my opinion, it's not that something bad happened to you and you became an addict to handle something that bad happened to you.
Okay.
I believe that trauma could exacerbate addiction. It could make it grow at a faster rate, but that it's not the cause. It's not like me having learning disabilities as a kid turned me into an addict. Like, I don't believe that. I believe that I was born with a very special brain, and given the circumstances and the environment that I was raised in, it gave me, it perpetuated me to become over time an addict. So I think that's really important because it takes the shame and the blame away. The other thing I think we really need to look at is this biopsychosocial piece, which is addiction affects me biologically. It affects my physical body. It affects the way my brain operates. It affects on a chemical level.
Yep.
Socially. It affects my relationships. When I interact with another person, that's affected by the nature of my disease.
Yeah.
Psychologically, it affects the way I think and it affects the way I feel.
Mm-hmm.
And it affects me spiritually. It affects the way I interact with the universe.
Yeah.
whatever that spiritual means to you, addiction will affect that, right? Okay. So those four pieces. Okay. But I think it all comes down to the brain. So there's essentially these three, you can break the brain into like these three main evolutionary parts. Okay. You have the brainstem, which essentially connects your brain to your spinal column. Mm-hmm. It's responsible for basic life function, like heart rate, blood pressure, temperature. If you don't have a brainstem, you're not alive. It's very, very basic.
Yep.
It's just literally keeping you alive. And then you have this thing called the limbic system. Your limbic system, your reward center is found in your limbic system. So it's responsible for like emotional regulation and other survival aspects, but not life-sustaining survival, more like shelter, sex, hunger, things like these life processes that you need in order to sustain your life.
Yeah.
And then we have this amazing part of our brain, which is called the prefrontal cortex. It sits in our forehead, mm-hmm. Which is why we have a forehead, right? And that enables us to like solve problems, have a sense of humor, manipulate people and environments to get what we need. You know, it enables us to like form communities and social networks and things like that. And most animals don't have that. Like primates do, but like a dog or a cat doesn't have the ability to do that.
Right.
They're driven solely by instincts. Yeah. So the problem is if your reward system is hijacked by addiction, then you don't have full access to this advanced higher portion of your brain.
Yeah.
So I'll be like in my car on my way to go to the store to get drug food while my prefrontal cortex is telling me, Dave, don't go to the store,
right.
But I'm on my way to the store. It's just more primal.
Yeah.
So it's more survival based. So it's as if the brain perceives me not getting a fix as a survival threat.
Mm.
So again, I think it helps us to release some of the guilt and shame associated with why are we doing things that we don't want to be doing?
Yeah.
It also explains why willpower won't work.
Right.
Because we can't, willpower is in that advanced part of the brain. We can't yep. access it. It's inaccessible. Yeah. So we have the thought, but it's as if we can't act on it.
Yeah.
Which wow. is the conundrum.
Right. So how does one override those instincts to do something that they really don't want to do?
I think one of the biggest pieces is community. I think that people need to be in an environment that supports them to do hard things.
Okay.
We've all done hard things, right? Yep. Like yep. I got off of 25 years of it prescribed amphetamines. Like, was that easy? No, it wasn't easy, but yeah. I did it, right? So, yeah. So I think being in an environment that where people accept the disease and are working towards repairing their life one day at a time. I think that's part of it. I think there are things that we can tell ourselves that are really simple and quick that can kind of tap into that reward system. Like things like just not today. Like yeah. my mentor says, like she has a thought about a certain food or a certain behavior. And she says to her brain, not today. Right. So we have to come up with these simple things that can kind of sink into that part of the brain that can be simple reminders. But I think the other thing is that we can actually repair the brain. Like we can create new pathways yep. that are different. And how we do that is by doing things over and over again. So earlier I was talking about how you can't really think your way out of this one.
Yeah.
You're going to have to act your way out of it. And so just by doing these simple behaviors over again and being around other people that are doing the same kinds of behaviors, not necessarily the exact same thing.
Yeah.
It helps us to mirror it, to mimic it, and to be, and we're not feeling like an outsider. We're not relying as much on willpower because it's in our environment now. People yeah. are like, we can normalize recovery.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is awesome.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. There's some freedom that comes with that. Like you're saying, you take away the guilt and the shame that you feel like it's all your doing or all your fault. When in essence, it's just how you're made. It's just your genetics, it's your environment.
I think that if we go back thousands of years, it served a purpose. Mm-hmm. I really do. I feel like it was these were the kinds of people that were going to survive.
Yeah.
They were hardwired for survival.
Right.
I think eventually evolved with the introduction of even if you look at a natural drug, like some people might consider like cocaine natural because it comes from a plant. It's still highly processed. I mean,
right.
We weren't designed to take it in a white powdered form, right? So it overrode our system.
Yep.
Maybe we were designed to chew the leaves, but yep. we weren't designed to snort the powder up our nose.
Right.
So it's just an example of how we've made it possible for addiction to become so pervasive.
Yeah.
By the way that we've manipulated nature. And now there are synthetic drugs too, and they work much faster and they're much harder to get off of. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. So if we talk about sugar, I mean, what would you kind of explain what is sugar that, I mean, is it an all or nothing? Like when you say you are addicted to sugar, sugar is your poison. What is this, an all or nothing? I can never, ever have honey. I can never have an artificial sweetener. I mean, how does that look to one who does have food addiction?
So the reason I use sugar addiction terminology is because I think it makes sense to people. Whereas when you say food addiction, people kind of get a little confused in terms of like, what do you mean? I'm like addicted to broccoli. And like, so they're thinking like, well, no, I don't have a problem with broccoli. I'm not a food addict.
No.
Right? But generally speaking, you might hear terms like processed food addiction, sugar addiction. So that's the reason I use the term sugar. And so what I mean by that is that, so actually Eric Clapton did this interview on, I think it was on 20 minutes and, or 60 minutes rather. And he was interviewed and the guy was like, so your first drug was heroin? And he's like, no, it was sugar. And he basically says, and he defines a drug as being anything that changes the way that you think or feel, which is really powerful coming from someone like Eric Clapton, who's, I mean, he's, you know, his addiction story is long. So, and he's a public figure, you know, so him coming out and being like, no, I was addicted to sugar at the age of 5. And he was talking about that he would do anything to change the way he thought or felt. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lot of addicts would identify with that piece.
Yeah.
So is there something that you take that changes the way you think or feel?
Yeah.
In terms of addiction, there's sort of two approaches. Some people approach it from a harm reduction model, which is a model which says like, let's minimize the damage that we're doing to ourselves. And then you have folks that come at it from an abstinence model, whereas we need in the brain to heal, we need to remove the drug.
Yeah.
So I'm definitely from the abstinence camp.
Okay.
So, and the people that find me know that. It's very clear when you come to my website or you listen to me on a podcast that I believe that if we put the substance in our body, that we will undergo the phenomenon of craving and we will not be able to stop.
Yeah.
So that's been my experience, is generally speaking, my client's experience, but it's selection bias. The people that find me want to have abstinence.
Yeah.
And so you ask questions about, so like, I look at artificial sweetener kind of like it's methadone of sugar.
Okay.
So I have no problem with a heroin addict who uses methadone or some other prescribed medication to get off of heroin. I think that's fantastic.
Okay.
The perspective for me is that, is the point of the drug to be temporary or is it to be long lasting?
Yep.
Right. So if we need to use sweetener in order to get a thrill so that we can get through our day long term, it can become problematic. If we're using sweetener as a crutch so that we can get off of sugar for a period of time and then work towards getting off of it, if we feel like there's some level of attachment to it, then it's useful as a tool.
Yep.
So each person is different. Now, some people can't eat certain things. Some people can. So I think we really need to be able to ask ourselves, like, in this situation, what would be best for my highest good, right? Is it me For instance, if someone's having a really hard time getting off sugar and processed food, we might, in the short term, encourage them to eat more natural foods above what they normally would consume, even more carbs than they would normally consume, in order to help them get off the processed food. So I'm not a, I don't have a problem with that. Like if someone needs to eat more fruit while they're detoxing off of sugar, who am I to say that's bad?
Right.
That's totally resourceful and helpful. Yeah. So I think we kind of have to find this position where we're okay with what we're doing, and also understanding that that position could shift and change.
Yeah.
Right. Like I realize that I have an issue with screens. I run an online business.
Yeah.
I need screens in my life. Right. So, so how do we look at those addictions that we can't run from? Yep. Like, I mean, I can put the foods down, but I can't like not have a screen.
Right.
I can't function in the modern world.
No.
So, what do you do with that? So how do we find that balance?
Yeah.
That's a challenge.
It is. Are there things that you have found that are more effective than others, or is it
in terms of
individual on managing that? Like for you, the screens,
I can set a commitment to not work after a certain time, and I can get rid of screens from that time of the day. Yeah. I can sort of make boundaries for myself that work around, like I won't be on screens around my kids, and I won't have my screen at the table, things like that.
Yeah.
Do you do it from time to time anyway? Yeah, of course you do. You know,
but that doesn't mean you've failed.
No, you're just kind of, well, process addictions are funny because it's not like you've taken a drug.
No.
It still lights up your brain. So I think you just have to find this place where you're comfortable and you can nurture your own growth, and as opposed to beating yourself up for making a mistake, because it's just part of life. You're going to screw up from time to time.
Yeah.
And I don't want to normalize relapse either.
No, right.
Right.
It's
so
fine.
Right. And because if you look at Prochaska's like model for change, a pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, you know, action, maintenance / relapse, like I don't like that the relapse is right there, because I think that it normalizes it, and it's not. You don't have to relapse.
No.
But you know, it's what you do when you're in that position where you find yourself that you're slipping back.
Mm-hmm.
Because a relapse doesn't start with a drug. It ends with the drug.
Yep.
So once you've relapsed back into your substance of choice or no choice, you're back in active addiction.
Yep.
And that's why I don't align with harm reduction. It's because it seems like in my eyes, it might put you in a constant state of relapse.
Mm.
That process of getting back to the drug.
Right. It's always there.
There are people that work with harm reduction. There are people that have great success with it. It's just not me.
Right.
If someone comes to me and wants harm reduction, I know who to send them to.
Okay.
Yeah. Because I'm not comfortable working with the model.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that's the opportunity that people have. They have to find what works for them.
Exactly.
And you have options. And if one doesn't work, you might need to try the other approach so that you get the help you need, so that you can find balance.
And I think it can also be a bridge.
Yeah.
Like there's no problem with tapering. Like that's what they do in the medical community to get people off of substance. Exactly. Look at what happens with the baby that's born from a mother who's on opiates. They literally have to taper morphine.
Yeah.
So it's normal. And it can be a really useful tool for people. Other people just want to rip the Band-Aid off and just get into detox and get it over with.
Yeah.
And that's fine.
Right.
Both of those work.
Yeah.
You just kind of have to, it's probably more based on your personality than anything else.
That's what I was thinking too.
Are you a Band-Aid ripper, or are you the kind of person that just slowly peels it away and feels that arm hair ripping off for 40 seconds? You know, I'm just a rip it off guy. So, but I have clients that do both.
Yeah. So if you think about bariatric surgery and how abrupt the diet changes with carbs and sugar and, grains because there's no space for it. Personally, as I've counseled tens of thousands of them, I feel like I see withdrawal.
Sure.
From those foods, even though you kind of wean them off pre-op, I feel like I still see some type of reaction after because it is so extreme. And, you know, are there things that you have noticed in the bariatric community with the sugar, the grains? I mean, do you find that most bariatric people can reintroduce those foods and have a maintenance type with them? Or do you find that a lot of bariatric patients do have that food addiction piece that it may have to be all or nothing?
I think there's very little reason for a normal eater. I hate the word normal, but someone who clearly doesn't have a pathological eating pattern with food that's mm-hmm. detrimental to their own preservation,
yeah,
to need bariatric surgery,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, yes, weight is one of the symptoms, but a lot of the things that bariatric surgery is used to treat are also symptoms. Yeah. High blood pressure, diabetes, those are all corresponding with metabolic syndrome and obesity, right?
Yep.
I find that there is no reason for a human to need certain foods.
Okay.
From a biological standpoint, right? So people can survive without carbohydrates as an example. People can survive without grains as an example. People can certainly survive without sugar and processed food, right? Yeah. That thrive even. So, you know, it's not my job to tell you that you're an addict. That's not helpful, right? There's a lot of stigma associated with addiction, and that's you know, something that might take someone some time to come to terms with. They might have to see patterns constantly in their life going through the same thing. Like Einstein, I think he said, doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, right? So like we're constantly going back to the same thing and we're ending up in the exact same position that we started. It's like yo-yo dieting.
Yep.
Bump, a bump, a bump. So how do we, you know, what do we do for the client that's getting ready for bariatric surgery? I think we need to screen them.
Yeah.
I think we need to give them the opportunity to see the writing on the wall if it's there. Like one of the tools is called there was a tool created for alcohol and then it was later adapted for marijuana. It's called the UNCOPE.
Okay.
It's six questions. It takes like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I actually had the bariatric center I work for add it into their initial like consult visit.
Yeah.
So it's a tool. Yeah. So it's changed from alcohol to food. Mm-hmm. And so it gives you an opportunity to say like, okay, basically, if you have more than two yes answers, we should do a little more digging. Mm. Some people come in with four, five, or six answers that are positive. And those people are likely dealing with an addiction, whether they want to believe it or not. Yeah. So I worked with this guy when I worked at Bariatrix, who was a licensed drug and alcohol counselor.
Okay.
And we created a group for helping. It was basically relapse prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So we looked at the operation and the like 2 week post-op period sort of as a detox.
Yeah.
And then we kind of started to treat the couple months after that as an intensive outpatient program where people would learn the addiction really schools tools and skills so that they could stay out of active addiction.
Yeah.
But it wasn't likely enough support for folks, you know, and you have to be kind of all in. And the other thing is a lot of the things that they ask patients to eat after surgery are loaded with things like processed food and artificial sweeteners and things like that. So if that's something that cues your demons, then what are you going to do? Right. People are always asking me, like, how do I find a clean protein powder? Like, it's pretty hard.
Yeah.
There's a lot of stuff in there. Look at the ingredient list. There's like 40 things, you know?
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I think it is challenging, but I would imagine that a very large amount of the population does meet the criteria for substance abuse disorder or addiction.
Very, very interesting. So think about like binge eating disorder and eating disorders in general compared to food addiction. Where's the line? How do we know the difference, or is there a difference?
Well, the first problem is that food addiction isn't in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual of Mental Illness, the DSM.
Yeah.
So a lot of people don't actually know that it exists, or they lump it up with binge eating disorder.
Yes.
Here's the problem. The treatment is completely different.
Mm.
The treatment for binge eating disorder is moderation, generally speaking, and emotional regulation. And the treatment for addiction is, in my eyes, abstinence and brain retraining and or in some lines, harm reduction.
Yeah.
So very common times a food addict will go into eating disorder treatment, and they're literally like try to teach them how to moderate drug foods. They'll try to teach them how to have like to feel okay with like eating foods that are bad for them.
Right.
And so it can be very counterproductive. So I think I look at food addiction or sugar addiction as if it's a pathological illness.
Mm-hmm.
And one of its symptoms is emotion, like the inability to regulate emotions. But generally speaking, that's caused by the drug. As opposed to being caused by trauma, emotional disturbance, poor coping mechanisms, things like that.
Okay.
To be honest with you, I'm not an expert in eating disorders.
Sure.
If someone with an eating disorder came into my office, I would have no idea how to help them. I would probably use the tools that I use for addicts, and maybe they would help a lot.
Yeah.
I do see a lot of people with both. Yeah. And when they do treat the addiction, generally speaking, there are massive improvements.
Yeah.
But that's not for everyone. I mean, there are some situations where abstinence would be harmful.
Yeah.
And I think some of the people with severe pathological eating disorders and lots of what we call dieting noise, which is like really intense restriction and long periods of fasting and which is common in bulimic and anorexia and things like that. But I would, if they came to me, I would recommend someone like David Wiss. He's a dietitian that works with both recovery and eating disorders. And he's an expert. He's out of LA.
Okay.
So I would send them somewhere, someone who specializes in that, because I don't.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So it can be pretty complicated. It's because it's a fine line for some of these things. And I don't think, you know, like you're saying, they're not even recognized. So they're getting labeled incorrectly to some degree. So unless you have an expert that understands the differences, they may be treating them inappropriately and doing more harm than good and not really serving that person, not by, you know, wanting to do that, but just out of unknowing, not being informed.
How many dietitians do you think one of your patients has seen before they've seen you?
How many dietitians has a patient seen before they've come in? Zero to one.
Oh, okay. So not that many. But the reality is that when they do see a dietitian, they're probably trying to teach them a moderation model.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So they're trying to teach them, you know, how to have the ice cream on the weekend, or how to minimize harm, or how to eat more fruits and vegetables or whatever. Right. So, and that doesn't help the brain if they have an addiction. It makes it worse.
Yeah.
The other thing is, when an addict works with a professional one-on-one, it's likely to actually increase denial.
Mm.
As opposed to help challenge denial. So, because we're hearing the same message from the same person, right? So the brain might say something like, yeah, what does this person know? They're just one person, right? Yeah. So when you have a collective group of people that have found success doing a specific thing in a specific way, it carries much more power. And then I think it helps us break through that the subliminal denial, the denial we don't even know exists.
Yes, exactly. That awareness that we've not recognized.
Right. It becomes a reality.
Yeah. And then you can help yourself at that point. Until then.
You can start to.
You can start to. Yes, you're right. I'm sure it's a long journey.
Because there are people that know that they're addicts, but they can't stop using.
Or they don't want to stop. Do some people just...
I think there are some people that want to stop.
And they just can't.
And they can't.
Yeah.
And the disease is progressive. It just gets worse. And
yeah,
it just gets harder and harder and harder and harder.
Yeah. Yeah. Agreed. I think it's just complex in the obese individual, because I think there's many factors that can play a role. How they got there. I mean, society in general has done a poor job at building these people up to give them confidence to want to change. So I think, you know, we've not done them any service. And as healthcare professionals, we're supposed to be experts in areas. And we've not, you know, we've not offered them good options. Like we offer them moderation of continuing junk. How is that helping inflammation in their body? How is that improving their gut health? How is that improving their brain health? It's not.
Correct. Right. It's trading harm for harm. It's sad.
It is sad. It's
because there aren't available options. You're talking about something that, let's see, if a third of America is overweight and a third's obese, so two thirds is overweight or obese. So that's like, let's call it 65%.
Yeah.
What percentage of those people are addicted?
Oh my God.
Probably, I don't know, at least 50 to 75% of that population, I would imagine, would meet criteria for addiction.
Wow. Right.
And then you also have the other third of normal weight folks who also have addiction, like myself. I never had a weight problem.
Yep.
So maybe I was up 10 pounds from where I'm at now, but that was never one of the symptoms I had to deal with.
Yeah.
In fact, leaner food addicts are one of the hardest people to treat.
Interesting.
Because the consequences aren't apparent or as apparent.
Yeah, society.
And just because they're thin doesn't mean that they're metabolically healthy either.
Correct. Yes.
And just because that they're overweight doesn't mean that they're metabolically unhealthy.
Correct.
So I think there's a lot of variables at play. But so what does that leave us with? Probably 60% of the American populace probably would meet criteria for substance abuse with food. It's scary. It's a lot of people.
That is a lot of people. But yeah, it's so accepted. It is just so accepted. Right,
it's normal. Normalized anyway.
Yeah. So how does one heal? Now, and for me on my WLS Gut Health website, my focus is gut health. When you get down to the biology with, you know, bariatric patients, we are altering their digestion. We are altering their gut microbiome, some ways very, very positive. And then depending on how that patient continues with their food choices and their lifestyle and community and socialization and all that kind of determines what happens to that benefit with bariatric surgery. Do you find that biology in general, you know, working on gut health, because we know that the, you know, gut and brain communicate, is there value in helping someone, even if it's short term or small, is there benefit in helping them address getting their gut health in a better place?
Is there benefit in terms of their addiction, you mean?
I would say in their ability to be successful with their addiction. I don't think, you know, focusing on your gut health is going to be the end all be all. That is not the solution. But I think the biology that occurs in our gut can make it easier for us to make different choices.
So the brain is, the gut is responsible for production of like dopamine and serotonin. So in even in a like even the building blocks of those things.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that gut health is part of the equation. I mean, right. And when we have set people up into an eating modality, look at you like yeast.
Yes.
Like yeast is going to scream for sugar.
Yes.
Right. So if we manage that, then there's a likelihood that our cravings would go down.
Right.
And then if our cravings went down, our urges would go down and our behaviors would go down, then our brain would begin to quiet. Right. So you could look at it from that perspective. I think that we have to treat the whole body.
Yes, I agree.
So, but in the fetus, I mean, the brain and the gut split. So there's a highway there.
Yeah.
So, you know, whether that's an increase of fermented foods or, there's all sorts of different ways that we can heal the gut.
Absolutely.
Some people need to go carnivore to heal their gut. So
I know.
There's all sorts of different, which is a modality that we see in our community. I mean, a number of our clients are carnivore. They find that that's the only thing that's ever worked for them. So how do we incorporate these things without letting go of what the primary illness is, which is a hijacked reward system? Because even if you heal your gut and you eat a donut, I mean, you're off and running, you're done. So it doesn't really matter how much your gut is healed.
Correct.
If you continue to use the foods that
cause
you cravings.
Yes. Yeah. There is no probiotic that's going to stop you from making poor choices or heal the addiction. That doesn't exist.
Right. Right.
No, I think it's, again, I'm in total agreement. It's the whole body. You can't. And I feel like in bariatrics that we've missed that. We have missed this 100%. Piece. And we are, I don't want to say we're doing more harm, but we are not providing a full scope to allow people to fully heal and fully get what they deserve out of, having this surgery, because we're missing this piece.
I think I would even go further to say in primary care.
Ooh. Yeah, absolutely.
It's missing.
Yeah.
In the hospital systems, it's missing.
Whole healthcare in general. Yeah.
Yeah. It's pervasive.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if we can normalize having this conversation about addiction, about how food addiction is real, I think it allows opportunity for bariatric patients to tap into healing. That they won't be going back to their surgeon and saying, I need a revision because I've gained all my weight back. And the revision is not the answer. It is addressing these issues.
Right, right, right. The elephant in the room.
Yes.
So to speak. Yeah. And when folks change the way they live,
right?
Their life changes.
Yeah.
It's the only way their life changes. Otherwise, it will change temporarily. Like the pattern that I saw was that folks would lose the weight for surgery because they've been dieting their whole life. They know how to diet. I mean, anyone can do that for a short period of time.
Yep.
It might be hard, but you can muster up the willpower if you have enough consequences.
Yeah.
Then they lose their weight for 6 months. They plateau for 6 months, and then they start gaining weight after a year. After their first year.
Mm-hmm.
And I would venture to say that most of those people would probably meet criteria for addiction.
Wow. Yes. Right?
'Cause they had a surgery. They know that this is their shot. They know it's a tool. Like they know all the facts.
Yep.
Yet they can't stop.
No. Right.
They could blow their stomach out, end up on a ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
With aspiration pneumonia and all this other stuff.
Yep.
Can they stop? No.
Mm-mm.
They can't stop. The consequence is never going to be enough.
Mm.
Think about a heroin addict, right? They could die the next time they use. Does it stop them from using? No. I've been at treatment centers where they are begging to get out. And they know full well that if they use again, they could die, especially after detoxing.
Yeah.
There is high susceptibility for an overdose.
Wow.
A fatal overdose.
Wow.
They know there's fentanyl. They know all that stuff. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Their survival brain wants a hit. It's life or death to them.
Yeah.
And we get food addicts that are at the point where they're not using to get high. They're using to avoid the pain of withdrawal. Right? They're using to avoid a headache, to avoid nausea and vomiting. They're using so that they're not feeling empty to their stomach. All those things, tremors, shakes.
Yep.
It all happens, can happen from food. Does everyone have it? No. Not everyone has withdrawal symptoms, but I would say most people do. I met a 21-year-old kid yesterday who had withdrawal symptoms. She mentioned 4 or 5 of them.
Wow.
21.
That's awful.
It progresses faster than you think.
Yeah. I mean, to some degree, it just, you feel, you know, the food industry has sold everyone that they do a better job at cooking and we should outsource our food to them. And in reality, we are outsourcing our brain to them.
Right. Yeah. We're handing them our health on a platter.
Yeah.
And I don't, it's not a gamble I'm willing to take anymore because it's a gamble.
So you've been on the side of you've had addiction and you've been on the side where you are in a safe place with addiction. Do you find that the road to that is long, hard?
I would say it's definitely not a straight line.
Okay.
It's kind of squiggly.
Yeah.
I think we expect it to go, you know, from the bottom of the graph to the top of the graph, from the bottom left corner to the top right corner, right? As you're looking at time and growth, right? But yeah. It's more like kind of all over the place. there's lots of hills and valleys and bumps and circles and loop-de-loops and that. So I definitely think that life gets lifey, you know? You're going to have sick parents and sick kids and, you know, maybe your kids are going to have learning issues. All that stuff is going to affect your recovery, right? The time that you used to spend recovering is going to have to be ciphered off into all this other stuff that life is going to throw at you. So I think that's true. I'm not past addiction. I'm just as susceptible as anyone else to going back out. It's just a matter of, am I willing to do the things that I've done on all my other days since I've been in recovery to stay in recovery today?
Yeah.
Right. And I think you get to a point where the routines that we have, which seemed like work, they become rituals, right? So they actually imbue meaning into our life.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have to pray, I get to pray, you know? I don't have to meditate, I get to meditate. I don't have to journal, I get to journal, right? Yeah. So it like gives my life purpose and meaning.
Yeah.
I never had that meaning when I was active. So it keeps me in life to stay in recovery. If I were to exit recovery, I wouldn't have any meaning in my life. I would just be a robot checking off checklists. And if I were to re-enter recovery, it would feel like work.
Yeah.
At first. But you get to a point where it doesn't feel like work at all. It feels like play. So
yeah.
And I think the community helps with that. I think being around others that understand really help with that. And so yeah. So it's not a straight line. If we expect it to be, we're going to be, you know, I've heard it said that an expectation is a resentment under construction. So if I expect that my recovery is going to go smoothly just because I'm doing everything right, I'm going to be rudely awakened. Yeah. So, yeah.
Yeah.
So I get to enjoy most of the days I get to live now, you know, and that wasn't what it was like before. Are they all filled with rainbows and butterflies and lollipops? No, not at all. Sometimes we have to do really hard things. Yeah. You know.
Yeah.
So.
And not check out with our addiction.
Right. Right. And I never used because I wanted to check out. I used because I was an addict. You know, and I think any other reason to use other than the fact that I'm an addict will never be sufficient. So why did I drug? You know, the answer to that question is absolutely useless to me. I used because I was an addict, because I had a special brain.
Yeah.
And it helps me to relieve myself of all the guilt.
Yeah.
Of like, well, you knew better. Yeah, but you had a disease. I mean, you're not going to get mad at someone for having cancer.
Right.
You know, you're not going to have a problem going to the ER with a broken arm.
No.
But I don't see anyone lining up at the door with a broken brain. So
no. You're right.
So, yeah. And so, yeah, and that connects back to the gut health, right, too, because it connects back to the brain health.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And in the end, yeah, look at the whole body, focus on what you can do today or right now.
And there are a lot of things that we can do that aren't that challenging.
Yeah.
That will address the whole body. Weightlifting, taking a walk in nature, eating the right foods. Yeah. These things don't just treat our gut. They treat our whole body. They treat our hormones. They treat our neurotransmitters.
Yep.
So I think if we follow that approach, we're definitely taking a forward direction.
Yeah. And you're going to have a better chance at living the life you want.
Exactly.
Yeah. Agreed. All right, David. Awesome, awesome info. How can people find you? I know you do a weekly group. And then you have programs.
We have a group every Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern. That's public access. Anyone can go. And in order to get the link, you can just sign up for our newsletter. And you can also grab our new Craving Crusher ebook at sugarxglobal.com. So that's a great way. We also run free educational events. So we actually have a 5-day challenge coming up on January 10th, and that will give you the opportunity to interface with people who, well, identify with cravings and they want to crush them. And it will give you an experience to take you through, to give you the tools and resources that you need to crush your cravings, along with the three of us, myself and my two colleagues, and we run the challenge. We coach you through the whole thing. And so that's awesome. And we have a community. And that's also sugarxglobal.com. You can get the information and access to that, because that's where people are changing. They're changing in that platform. And it gives you the opportunity to interact with all these other people that have the same goals and aspirations that you do.
Yeah.
Which is a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Agreed. Yeah. I think that's awesome. You guys have this whole program and you have a way to interact socially, because I feel like that's a huge, huge piece.
It is a huge piece. I mean, what if you could have a platform off of social media where you don't have to look at flashy, shiny things, where the focus is just on repairing your life and getting yourself back on track and staying there and, you know, and all the things that really we've talked about today. And there's no white noise. There's no pretty pictures of food. There's no recipes that you need to look up. And, you know, it's distilled.
Yeah.
It's just distilled medicine.
Yeah. Which is awesome.
It is.
And you also have a website, right?
Sugarxglobal.com. I started a business a long time ago, but it's kind of phasing out just because I'm finding that people don't make progress one-on-one, really. So I've stepped away. I'm stepping away from the one-on-one work, and we're doing the group work because that's where people are really changing.
That's awesome. I like that. I like that.
Because it works. The one-on-one work is, well, it's challenging for the end user and it's challenging for the coach.
Yep.
It's a lot. It's a lot of effort. And when you put someone in a group where a bunch of people want to change and reach towards the same goals, it's synergistic. It just happens. It's just like clicks.
That's awesome.
A machine. So, yeah.
Do you find, are your groups pretty big or are they small groups?
So the free Thursday group can pull anywhere between like 40 and 100 people. Wow. But the small groups that are in the community, I would say they're relatively small. They're definitely less than 30. Wow. Some have 15, some have 20, some have 25.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah,
a good place to be.
Definitely. Yeah. Yeah. They're intimate for sure.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Awesome. Thank you so much, David. And, hopefully we can chat again sometime soon.
I hope so.
Yeah. I enjoyed this. Thank you.